What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It's been 569 days since October 7th, 2023, and in that time, the Zionist-occupying state of Israel has claimed over 70,000 Palestinian lives, of which the majority have been women, children, and elders, and we know that even that large number is an undercount, as many bodies remain under the rubble. Here on Law and Disorder, we have spent the majority of these Mondays bringing you Palestine Post, where we push back on the mainstream media's misinformation, disinformation, in an attempt to justify a genocide in order to maintain the status quo. Today, we're going to spend the majority of our hour unpacking Hamas as an organization. Our guest today is Rami Kouri, a distinguished public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, a journalist and author with 50 years experience covering the Middle East, and also the co-author of a brand new book called Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters. Good morning, Kouri.
Hey, good morning. Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you back on the show. We're going to get to the book soon, but I feel like there's a few headlines that we need to touch on first. The headline that Israeli forces have murdered at least 71 Palestinians in the past 24-hour reporting period, according to the health ministry in Gaza, 36 people since dawn. Can you talk about your understanding of the further uptick of Israeli violence, aggression over the last couple of months in Gaza, an attempt to push them completely out of the strip?
Sure. It's not really just the last couple of months. It's the last century. This battle between political Zionism and Palestinian Arab nationalism started really in 1917. And it's been going on ever since, when the early Zionists convinced the British to support the creation of a Jewish home in Palestine, to create a Jewish state on a land that was 93% Palestinian Arab, which is Palestine, under the Ottomans. And then the British, after World War I, took control of it. And ever since then, there's been this tension between Zionism, which ultimately created the state of Israel, and the Palestinians. And the Palestinians have never been able to secure their rights, have never been able to secure global support at a significant level, while the Zionists and the state of Israel has, to the point where today the United States and Great Britain and Germany and others are not only acquiescing in the Israeli genocide in Gaza, but are active participants in it. They provide the funding, the political cover, the armaments. So this has been going on for a long time. What's happening now, yeah, since October 23, is a plausible genocide, as the International Court of Justice called it. Yeah. And this is unprecedented at this level. There's always been efforts for the past century by the Zionist movement to expel Palestinians, to kill them, to harass them. What you see going on in the West Bank now, where there were marauding bands of Israeli settlers, often provided with machine guns by the United States government recently, they are typical of what Zionist groups have been doing for the last century, which is harassing Palestinians, getting them off the land, scaring them, killing them now and then, imprisoning them, just to get them to leave, because they want to create an Israeli Jewish state. And they did. They created it in 48, and now they keep expanding it. And they want all of Gaza. They want this part of Lebanon. They have already taken parts of Syria. So you need to see the process by which the state of Israel, or the Zionist groups before the state, the process by which they use violence against Palestinians, often indiscriminately and without cause, without being attacked in many cases. In some cases, they were attacked because there's a war going on. This is not a picnic. This is a war. It's a century-old war. And the Israelis are winning the military battle, but they're losing the political battle, because most of the world supports the Palestinian right to self-determination and their own state alongside the state of Israel. The Israelis have really never developed a strategy to address the Palestinian rights issue politically. They only know how to use military force, and they've been given almost nonstop for 100 years the support they need from the Western imperial colonial powers. And that's why we're in this situation where the Israelis, they attacked Lebanon yesterday again. They bombed part of South Beirut, where I was in Beirut yesterday. I came today mm-hmm. to, I'm in Doha, Qatar. This has been going on for a long time. And the main explanation, as I see it, is that Zionism and the State of Israel have never adopted a strategy for dealing with the Palestinians other than military force. Mm-hmm. And they come up with all kinds of reasons to do it, most of which are not accepted under international law, to the point where the Israelis now are trying to essentially destroy international law and ignore it. The International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, has warrants out for the Prime Minister and the former Defense Minister, and they just ignore these things. And Western powers go along with them and also tell them, ignore the ICC and the ICJ, don't worry about them. So the foundations of international law that were created after World War II, essentially to prevent another case of genocide that's happened to the Jews in Germany, those foundations are being now destroyed by the Jews Israelis in Israel, which is quite extraordinary, and way below the normal morality level of all the Jewish people I know in my life, who have been mostly wonderful mm-hmm. people, like all people are around the world. So what's going on is both extreme and unusual, but at the same time consistent with a historical pattern, and it will not be resolved through any local effort between Israelis and Palestinians or Arabs, because now you've got Lebanese, Syrians, Yemenis, they're all engaged in some sort of warfare with Israel. This can only be resolved with massive international intervention that protects both the rights of Israel and the rights of Palestinians to live in peacefully in their own states. And this is what we all have to keep working for, I think.
Thank you, Corey. I was specifically referring to the uptick in violence post the ceasing of the so-called ceasefire. But thank you for that.
Yeah, I know. Let me just go ahead. I realize that. I'm sorry I didn't answer, but I gave you that longer answer to emphasize that it you have to see it in the longer time frame. And there'll always be reasons they'll come up with why they're doing it. They say to negotiate, to do this, to do that, but these mostly prove to be not credible. They just make up these reasons because they want to drive out the Palestinians. It's very simple.
Right. Right. And then quickly, Curry, because there's so much about your book that I want to get into, I would like your reflections. You mentioned the ICJ, that there are hearings happening right now around Israel's denial of aid and the accusation, the assertion, I'm not even calling it accusation, the fact that Israel is using the denial of aid as a weapon of war.
Yes, they've done all kinds of terrible things. Bombing civilian settlements, camps, tents, denying medical aid to enter, denying food, water, essentially a starvation policy. Every one of these actions is a war crime, the Israelis just don't care. They don't care about any legal protections that are supposed to protect innocent people around the world. They only care to the Israeli government, at least. Not all Israeli people are like that, but the Israeli government only cares to assert its power, knowing that it's protected fully by the United States so far, and uses violence, hoping that extreme violence will traumatize the Palestinians so much that they will pick up and leave. But they haven't done this in 100 years, and there's not, you know, there was a million Palestinians back when the conflict started, say around 1920 or so. There's now 13 or 14 million Palestinians, and there's nowhere for them to go. They don't want to go anywhere. They just want to have their rights in their own home. So the tactics that Israel is using clearly are recognized by virtually the entire world as immoral and illegal. And they're also ineffective. They don't achieve the goal they want, which is to have the Palestinians flee en masse and all leave so that they can set up new Jewish-Israeli settlements and have beachfront hotels. And this is really troubling because the the actions of the Israeli government become more and more vicious and ferocious and cruel over time, and the world doesn't seem to care about it. This lack of moral sensitivity to the cruelty and violence of the Israeli government, and this is the government, this isn't just a few marauding bands of criminals, this is the government, the state of Israel, starving children to death and seeing children die because they don't have medical care, or they die of thirst. And it's really something troubling to see this happen, and all the world is asking why do the majority of the northern states of the Democratic North not do anything about this and contradict their apparent or once in a while commitment to democracy and the rule of law and equal rights and human rights? So everything the Western world has said, headed by the U.S., seems to be nonsense, seems to be not applicable to Palestinians. And this is now includes making it a crime to be a Palestinian or to advocate for Palestinian rights in the United States, where people get arrested or evicted or thrown out of the country. It's really quite astounding to see the level, the ferocity of the anti-Palestinian demonization on the part. It's not surprising when the Israeli government does it, but when the U.S. government and other groups in the U.S. go along with this and in Europe, that's really a shocker. So we don't know where this is going to go, but it's certainly not going to see any kind of reduction in resistance by Palestinians, political, economic, military, whatever means they find, and also so many other people around the world who are supporting the Palestinians and trying to push both sides to a political, peaceful resolution of this conflict.
Thank you for that, Curry. Y'all, that takes us to 8:20 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. It's Monday, which means it's Palestine Post. We're in conversation with Rami Kori, a distinguished public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, a journalist and author with 50 years of experience covering the Middle East. He is also the co-author of a brand new book called Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters. We're going to turn to our conversation about Hamas now. Rami, let's get right into it. Take us to 1987. What were the political conditions that gave rise to Hamas? From whence did they emerge?
The emergence of Hamas, like the emergence of Hezbollah before it in Lebanon, is very similar. It's because the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank, during the First Intifada, the uprising against Jewish occupation, and they had been occupied since 1967, lack of the ability of the Palestinian state, or no, it wasn't a state, but the Palestinian leadership or the Arab people, Arab governments around it, their lack of ability to protect Palestinians from ferocious Israeli moves like blockades and strangling them economically and like they're doing now, not letting in enough food and not letting them travel for medical care. I mean, all these terrible things were going on, and the Israelis were shooting and killing and injuring and imprisoning thousands of Palestinians, shooting and killing, you know, probably a couple of hundred, but thousands were imprisoned. That pushed the group that was part of the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza to create a movement which they called Hamas, which is stands an Arabic acronym for Harak al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya, which means the Islamist or the Islamic resistance movement. They see it as a resistance movement that resists the terrible things that Israel is doing to them and tries to push back and achieve a political resolution of the conflict. Early on, when Hamas was first created, they didn't want to resolve the conflict peacefully with Israel because they didn't recognize it. But they changed that about two decades later, and the charter of Hamas and the political position that all the Hamas people agree to, which is agreed to by all the Arabs, is to negotiate a permanent resolution with the state of Israel that ends the occupation of 67, allows self-determination for Palestinians, releases thousands of Palestinian prisoners. There's about 10,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, many of whom have never been charged with anything. and allows the refugees to regain some of their rights, whether a few of them go back to living in their original homes inside Israel now, but the majority won't go back because Israel won't accept that. They wanted a Jewish state. They created a Jewish state. They want to get the Arabs out. But the Palestinians will keep struggling and pushing until they get the recognition that they have the right to go back, as the UN says they do, and international law says they do. And they'll have to negotiate. Israel and Palestine will have to negotiate, you know, can a symbolic number, maybe a couple hundred thousand or a million or something, go back to live in their old homes or old residence villages in what is now the state of Israel. But the majority of Palestinians will not go back to Israel. They'll live in a Palestinian state or maybe move somewhere else. That's to be negotiated and determined in the future. The key point there is that unlike what Israeli propaganda, which is parroted by American politicians, says, the Palestinians are not out to destroy the state of Israel and kill the Jews. They're out to end the Israeli subjugation and occupation of Palestine and to allow Palestinian self-determination and statehood to happen so that there can be finally a situation of justice which brings about peace and stability throughout the entire Middle East.
Curry, I want to tug just a little bit more on that thread there from the first charter, right, of 1987 to the shift in 2005. What caused that shift from the utilization of violence to the tenets that were put forth in 2005, a shift in strategy and the projected ideology? What got them?
Exactly the same thing that happened to the United States government and military and people in Vietnam in the 70s and in Afghanistan 10 years ago, which is they come to their senses. They realize that military force is not going to resolve that particular conflict, wherever it may be, and that you have to negotiate a resolution of this conflict. In the case of the United States, it meant that the U.S. had to get out of Vietnam, get out of Afghanistan, leave the Vietnamese and Afghans to run their own country. And it was essentially an acceptance of defeat of the United States, the strongest power in the world, by these ragtag guerrillas in Vietnam and Afghanistan. And the U.S. left. And the Palestinians similarly have learned that they're never going to be able militarily to defeat Israel, given the immense power of the state of Israel, its technological capabilities, and the full support it has among most Western countries. So they realize that they have to make a compromise, and they made a historic compromise, which is essentially to tell the Israelis, you can have three quarters of historic Palestine and just leave us one quarter, which is the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. And this is a compromise that the whole Arab world has accepted. It was in the 2002 Arab peace plan that the Arabs presented. But the Israelis have never responded to this kind of approach. But Hamas keeps making it. They've made about 15 or 18 formal overtures to the Israelis, and once in a letter to George Bush to the U.S., stating clearly their willingness to negotiate peacefully to end the conflict and to coexist peacefully with the state of Israel if a Palestinian state emerges and the Palestinians get their rights. These are not easy issues to resolve, and they'll take a long time, and they'll also require massive international involvement, whether it's pressure, cajoling, or funding, or whatever. But you'll have to have a lot of international involvement in pushing both sides towards a peaceful, negotiated resolution of the conflict. And that's why Hamas has kept stating these things. And just last week, they said it again, that if the Israelis leave Gaza and they stop attacking and the borders are open and the Palestinians in Gaza can get everything, food and water and medicine, things they need, and rebuild their society, that the Palestinians will live with an Israeli state, but they'll negotiate their own rights. And this is something that they also have been alluding to when discussions come up about, well, who's going to rule Gaza, who's going to run Gaza. Hamas has been saying they don't particularly want to run Gaza. They don't want to be the rulers of all Palestine. They want the Palestinian people to have their rights and not to be jailed in the tens of thousands at a time in Israel, or to be killed in 50,000 at a time in Gaza, as is happening now, or to be starved by the millions, as is happening now. And Hamas is saying they're a resistance movement. They're resisting what Israel is doing to them, but they're prepared to coexist if Israel adopts a more rational, sane, and a law-abiding approach to its relations with the Palestinians. And Hamas has said if a Palestinian state is created and the conflict is resolved peacefully, they will disband their military arm. They'll provide anything they have to the new Palestinian government that would be elected and would have the right to rule Palestine democratically. And they would be probably part of the government as a political party. They've said this many times, but they've never had a response from the Americans or the Israelis. And this is really puzzling and troubling, because it suggests clearly that Israel is not interested in a peaceful resolution. Neither are the American governments over the years. Individual people say things that are more forthcoming, but the governments, by their actions in Israel and the United States, do not indicate a desire to see Palestinian self-determination happen. They want to see the continued dominance of Israel. And this is one reason why I and many other people say, well, look, the conclusion that we have to draw from this is that the colonial period never ended, that the decolonization of the 50s and 60s and 70s around the world happened in many places, but it didn't happen in Palestine. And then the U.S. and Israel are now the colonial masters who want to dictate their terms of how everybody in the region lives, in Lebanon and Syria and Iraq and in Yemen and other places. And this is a real troubling realization, because it just means there's going to be endless fighting, endless suffering, mostly by civilians, and there's no need for that. And both people have suffered traumatic situations, the Israelis less than the Palestinians in terms of numbers killed. But the trauma of October 7 for the Israelis was phenomenal. And this kind of thing is inevitable if this kind of actions continue by the Israelis subjugating and killing the Palestinians. And the Palestinians will continue resisting in any way they can. But we shouldn't let that happen, because it just means endless suffering for millions and millions of people on both sides, which will never resolve the problem. Military might will not resolve this conflict any more than it resolved South Africa or Northern Ireland. It needs a political resolution. And this is what Hamas has indicated many times over the years, and has done so recently. And this is one of the reasons we produced this book, which is really five interviews with scholars who know Hamas inside out, where the scholars simply explain, you know, what Hamas is, where they come from, what they want, how they've evolved, why they've evolved, all the things that people should know about Hamas before they then make up their mind that they're a terrorist group, or they're peace-loving, reasonable people, or somewhere in between, whatever. But U.S. should not make the same mistake that it made in Afghanistan and Vietnam and then later in Iraq, by going into these wars without really knowing the local people or the environment in which they were sending their massive military might, to end up humiliated years later and having to leave.
Rami Curry, I want to tug on another thing you just mentioned. So your book, Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters, was born out of a conversation, a decision, an awareness, if you will, by the Board of Dutch World Education to, as you say, quote, challenge the reluctance of so many North Americans, including many purportedly pro-Palestinian groups, who hesitated to even start to discuss Hamas. You've talked about how you went about doing that. That's an interview with five experts. Talk about why it matters that we understand, we collectively, the world, right, understand Hamas, but also that we talk about it out loud.
I think it matters because there's a one second. It matters because the situation that pertains now is just going to keep going for years and years with endless suffering for everybody. And it's starting to impact in the United States now. For instance, you see some of the actions that the U.S. government is taking. It's curtailing the constitutional rights of Americans, of free speech, of the due process, and all the constitutional rights that Americans have. And then the U.S.'s government is, to help the Israelis, is clamping down on, for instance, advocacy for Palestine justice or for Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. The U.S. government is saying this is something that shouldn't happen. They call it anti-Semitism, which it's not. It's criticism of the predatory policies of the state of Israel. But this is starting to impact the U.S. and the rights of ordinary Americans. And people feel this in the U.S., and they're trying to push back against it as much as they can.
For those of you tuned in to Law and Disorder, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. It's Monday, which means it's Palestine Post, and we're in conversation with Rami Khoury, a distinguished public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, a journalist and author with 50 years' experience covering the Middle East. He is also co-author of a brand new book called Understanding Hamas and Why That Matters. Rami Khoury, I want you to talk a little bit about the relationship between Hamas and political prisoners, Palestinian political prisoners.
Yeah, the history of Hamas is one in which it has developed certain areas where its policies are very clear and very firm. I mentioned they want liberation, they want self-determination, statehood, and release of prisoners is one of those. And this is something that has long been a core demand of Hamas, partly because it impacts so many people across the occupied territories. I think the latest statistics I've seen is that since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, I think something like 20% of all males have been through Israeli jails. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary figure. And so the suffering that all Palestinians feel because of the Israeli policy of grabbing Palestinians and throwing them in jail, often without accusations and without trials, it impacts everybody in Palestine. And so they see this as important at the level of just, you know, people feeling that they can live a decent life. But it's also symbolic because it shows that Hamas is the group that really cares about the rights of all Palestinians and is trying to work to achieve those rights. And this is why they keep focusing on it. And by the way, the Palestinian, the Hamas position on coexistence with the state of Israel under certain conditions was worked out in negotiations among many Palestinian leading groups like Fatah and Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and others. Many of these groups that had their prisoners in jail, they met in jail for years and years and worked out this position, which was then negotiated and agreed to by all the Palestinian factions. And one of Hamas's cardinal operating methods has been always to work for a consensus among Palestinians so that all the Palestinians feel that their sentiments are represented in whatever policy decisions are made by the Palestinian leadership, which is not the case now with the existing Palestinian leadership of Fatah-dominated Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas. And this is one of the areas where Hamas feels that it has to get, historically, in recent decades, it got involved politically in elections and things like that, which it never used to do before, but now it does. Because again, it's one of the signs of realism that have come to define its actions.
You mentioned Hamas's position on the rights of all Palestinian positions. I'm wondering if you can segue into the positionality of Hamas and where women fit in politics and resistance in society?
Well, Hamas is a conservative movement that was anchored in religious sentiments. It started as a social movement, and in Islam, traditional Islam, well, you know, it's a, these are conservative societies. Women didn't play a huge public role, but in the Palestinian movement, among all the groups, women have played a much more prominent role. Hamas's political leadership is all male, as far as I know, but there's consultations that go on throughout all levels of society, and this is an area where Hamas is often criticized, and they defend it by saying that they're working to achieve the national goals of all Palestinians, and then the role of men and women and youth and other groups in society will be decided through democratic processes in which all Palestinians are involved. So this is a kind of open-ended situation, but the women in Hamas are not politically active in prominent positions, though they are active in many critical elements or sectors in society, like education and sometimes the economy and health and other areas. But for right now, there's not a big move in the Hamas movement to address these issues, and this is something that they'll feel pressure from Palestinians to work on.
Rami Curry, what is the relationship between Hamas and other Arab nations, and how has it evolved over the years?
It's generally been tense because Hamas, being a resistance movement, somewhat of a revolutionary movement, it's challenging the status quo. It has arms. It uses its arms against Israel. It's used. They've gotten into battles against other Palestinians occasionally here and there, generally, its relations with other Arabs, with Arab governments, are not that good, because the Arab governments don't like revolutionary resistance and armed movements, especially movements that win elections, as Hamas did in the early 2000s. So they tend to have relations with some Arab governments historically who've been supporting them. They have working relationships that are good with Qatar and Egypt, who are the two main Arab mediators now in the attempts to mediate between Hamas and the Israelis for the release of the hostages and release of prisoners. But Hamas comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood movement, and the Muslim Brotherhood movement generally is not accepted by Arab governments, though many Arab people support it. And this is one of the situations that hasn't changed much since the 1930s. In fact, Jordan just, I think, banned the Muslim Brotherhood last week.
Rami, I want to talk about October 7th, 2023, and which clearly is right, not the beginning of this genocide. It is the day that masses across the world mark as a shift in what was happening in Palestine. We saw many people in the world, both sides of the issue, right? We saw, and I support, and you've said, right, concern for the loss of life. We did not see widely, however, and I think this goes to the point of the board, the Just World Education Board, of the necessity of this book. We did not see widely, however, out loud conversations about how October 7th came to be, what it was born from, right? There wasn't very much conversation about it being part of a resistance movement. What we saw was the power of narrative, not only used to spin, to exaggerate what happened that day, even though what happened that day was horrific, but also to further demonize Hamas and set the stage for an allowance by world powers, a continued allowance, an escalated allowance by world powers to turn a blind eye, or in the case of the U.S., to blatantly support what we see happening right now and have seen happening for the last 569 days. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so what you're seeing is, you know, Hamas made this attack on October 7, which was pretty unusual and daring. And clearly there were elements in the action that day that were unacceptable. That was violence against civilians, and not all the people who did the attack were Hamas. Hamas started, and then thousands of other Palestinians rushed into southern Israel from where they had been expelled as refugees in 1948. So there's a lot of unknown details about who killed who and who did what. And the Israelis army killed some of their own citizens with the attacks that they launched against Hamas when the battle started. So there's a lot of details that really have to be verified historically. But Hamas did this essentially to, I think, to, and most scholars think, to just shake up a situation that had been stalemated for decades and in which the world was not showing any care and desire to do anything to relieve the stresses and the pressures on the Palestinians, who were, again, limited in terms of what food Israelis allowed in, medical care, water, and things like that. It was a gamble in many ways, but it was also a sign of their willingness to gamble, to resist, because they were being subjected to inhuman conditions. That will be determined by the historical process. It's not for me or you or Israel or the American government or anybody to say this is right or this is wrong. The political situation is one that has so many dimensions that are historical, factual, moral, philosophical. You know, there's so many dimensions to this. And of course, the Israelis simply bring it down to one level, that Hamas is a terrorist organization and therefore they should be wiped out, and that's what they're trying to do. But most of the world doesn't accept that. Most of the world says, oh, they're a resistance movement. They've carried out some terrorism acts. The Israelis have carried out way more terrorism acts and their genocidal policy. So these are, again, facts that history will have to sort out.
Army Curry, we're going to have to wrap it up.
This is right. Yeah, so this is the emotion of the moment are not very conducive to a serious discussion. That's why we did this book, to let people see what is Hamas, where they come from, what they want, get to know who they are, and then decide. If you still think they're awful people, then, you know, carry out your war. But there should be some rational process there rather than all-out militarism.
Army Corps, one more question for you before we wrap it up. It's asserted in the book, we've talked about it here a bit, right, that we don't get to an end of the violence without Hamas being at the table as part of the negotiating process. Israel has said outright that will never happen. The United States has said outright that will never happen. There are other world powers that say absolutely not. Aside from us continuing to be in the streets by the tens of thousands, what do we do with that? How do we move forward?
Well, Hamas is not the issue. You know, it's not of whether Hamas is at the table. It's what Hamas represents. And what Hamas represents is a political consensus that the overwhelming majority of Palestinians and people around the world accept, and the UN accepts, which is for the Palestinian rights to, like I said, self-determination, statehood, etc. If Hamas is there or not, that's not an issue. And this is, again, how Israeli Zionist propaganda works. They divert your attention from what really matters. What really matters is the political positions that come to the table by both sides, from both sides, to be negotiated for a permanent resolution. And Hamas has clearly said they don't need to be in the government. They will disband. They won't exist as an organization. They'll turn their military over to the Palestinian National Army when it's formed. These are all issues where the compromises are very clear and very reasonable. We shouldn't allow Zionist propaganda and American echoes of that propaganda shape public thinking about who Hamas is or who Fatah is or who the Viet Cong are or who the Taliban are. These situations, you know, the white South African apartheid groups said the same thing about Mandela, and it turned out to be a bunch of lies. And I think the same thing will be discovered about Hamas and Palestine and Israel.
All right, Rami Curry, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Take care.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world for all of us to thrive in. That's it for this episode, fam. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programming is funded exclusively by listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Remember, we all we got.